Dakota comes from Fresno, so let's give her a warm welcome and thank her for driving down.
My name is Dakota, and I'm a real alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 21st, 2011. My sponsor is Billy W. and Janet W. That's sponsors. Apparently, I can't count. I'm really grateful to be here tonight. I'd like to thank Bill for asking me and the Valley Group for having me and all of y'all for coming, especially my Fresno peeps. So I'm just curious before I start, does anybody know how to drink? Is that a yes?
Yeah.
Okay, then I don't think we're going to talk about how I drank tonight, because I think what I really want to talk about more than anything is how I'm sober and how I'm staying sober one day at a time. I will give you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, but what it was like is going to be really short, because that's not the important part of my story. The important part of my story is how I'm standing here in front of you today, a grateful recovering alcoholic. To start off with, I was born into a really brutal household. It was actually a child prostitution ring in Northeast Ohio. I don't tell you this so that I can then say, and that's why I'm an alcoholic, because it's not. I believe that I was born an alcoholic, and if anything, the place that I come from accelerated that process for me. So that's where I come from, and it's part of my story, and I have to share it because I don't know who's out there and listening and what they might need to hear, because I do know that if I listen really close in these rooms, I hear my story, pieces of my story all over the place. The abuse was extreme from the get-go. When I was 3 years old, my great aunt was murdered over top of me, and I was immediately institutionalized in Cleveland State Hospital. This was in 1972, at a time where there were huge human rights violations happening in these hospitals. In fact, the hospital that I was in for a year and a half was closed in 75 for human rights violations. So you can imagine that life in the hospital wasn't any better than life at home. In fact, it was much worse. But what I learned in the hospital is that chemicals changed how I felt. They gave me meds. I call it drugs. I can't possibly think of what a 3, 4, 5-year-old could need in a hospital at that age to function normally. They medicated me, though. And I learned that the medication changed how I felt. And frankly, I didn't like how I felt. The world where I came from, I was taught that I was a piece of crap, that I would never amount to anything, that I was stupid, that I was a waste of precious oxygen. And so the message that I got was that I was nothing. There was everything wrong with me. I was not enough. I was not fast enough, pretty enough, smart enough. I was not anything enough. And when they put those medications in me in the hospital, I felt different. And I thought I was enough. I probably still wasn't. But I thought I was. It changed how I thought about who I was and the world that I lived in. And I liked it. I liked it a lot. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad was an alcoholic. He came from a long line of alcoholics. And my mom, I'm not sure if she was an alcoholic or a drug addict or both, but she was pretty much evil. And so when I got out of the hospital when I was 5 years old, I started stealing my dad's beer because I saw that people changed when they drank it. And I had found out that I could change how I felt if I took chemicals. So I started drinking my dad's beer at the age of 5. I believe that I was a full-blown alcoholic by the age of 9. I fully believe that. I was a binge drinker, but I like to say that my binges tended to be kind of long sometimes. I had a binge from 5 to 9, and another one from 9 to 13, and then another one from 13 to 18. So basically, I spent my entire childhood wasted. And I first walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 13 years old. I was sitting outside my high school, and I had carved in my arm. I had pieces of broken glass in my pockets. I collected them all the time. Because I hated who I was, and I hated how I felt. and I didn't want to feel like a piece of crap anymore. And so I would hurt myself with these pieces of glass. If getting loaded didn't do it for me, I would hurt myself. And so I carved in my arm with this piece of glass the letters BTL for Born to Lose. And I truly believed that I was born to lose. And as I sat there outside my high school, dripping blood on the snow, I just wished I could die, but I had tried to kill myself several times, and I couldn't even do that right. And I'm not trying to paint a picture of a victim to you guys today. I'm really not. Please understand that this is just my story. It's just where I came from, and that's how deep my angst was. A girl walked up to me and offered to walk me home. And I let her because she wasn't going to leave me alone otherwise. And she led me to her house, and she said, just come inside with me for a minute, and then I'll walk you the rest of the way home. So I did. And she left the room, and this man came out of the other room, and he was 6'2", 450 pounds. And he came in, and he sat down next to me, and he said, you're not going to leave here until you talk to me. So I did. Nobody cared what I had to say. Like, in my entire life, nobody had cared what I had to say. Nobody asked me how I was feeling. I wasn't allowed to have feelings. And so when this man sat down beside me and said, talk to me, tell me what's going on, I poured my heart out. I did not tell him what was happening in my home, but I did tell him what was happening inside of me and how lost and broken and destroyed I was. And he took me that day to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the weirdest thing happened when I walked in these rooms in Northeast Ohio, a little town called Painesville, 30 miles northeast of Cleveland. It was actually in my junior high cafeteria. And I thought it was so cool that here I was, just a freshman in high school, and I was back in my junior high cafeteria, and I could smoke. In the room. It was amazing. But the more amazing thing than that to me is that you people told me keep coming back. I don't really have the ability to communicate with you just how broken I was. And when you said keep coming back, I believed you. I'd love to be able to tell you today that I'm 32 years sober because I kept coming back, but that's not my story. My story is I kept coming back. I don't remember hearing them tell me to get sober. I don't remember hearing them tell me to get a sponsor. Not yet. I don't remember hearing them tell me to work the steps. I just heard them telling me to keep coming back. But you know what? Today, I'm glad I heard that much. Because even if they said all those other things and I didn't hear them, when I needed you, I knew where you were. And I knew that you would welcome me with open arms. Because those people, when I was 13 years old, told this broken kid to keep coming back. So if you ever feel like you're just like mouthing off the rhetoric of this program when you say keep coming back, or if you're new or fairly new and you hear people say keep coming back, it means way more than that. And today I say just stay. Because I wish they'd have said that to me. I did not stay. I ran away from my home when I was 14, and I lived on the streets. I found my way out to Napa, California, and I spent the next 4 years living on the streets. Doing the things that people do when they're living on the streets and they're alcoholics. I sold my own body. I had a severe problem of self-inflicted violence. I had severe eating disorders, and I was definitely a real alcoholic. I was what you would refer to as a common street whore. And that was just my path. But that wasn't all I did, because I also went to Alcoholics Anonymous. The first thing I did when I got to Napa was I found the Napa Valley Alano Club. And I went to a meeting. And I hooked up with somebody at a meeting, and I had sex with him. Because you didn't tell me to work the steps. You didn't tell me not to sleep with everybody. I did what I knew how to do. And that was all I knew how to do. I proceeded to spend the next 4 years in and out of the rooms. At certain points, I was the chairperson of the entertainment committee at the Napa Valley Alano Club. I would book the band for the dancers, and then I would get drunk with the band on their break. That was what I did. And you know, at some point in there, I heard you say, get a sponsor. And I heard you say, get somebody who has something that you want. So I did. Whether it was that I wanted their wife, or their husband or their girlfriend or their boyfriend. That was what I went after, and that was what I did. I was a 13-stepper in my entire adolescence in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how much of the program actually got into me. I don't have any idea. I didn't work the steps. I only got sponsors that I could manipulate or get their spouses to cheat on them or try to get them to sleep with me, because that's the kind of broken child that I was. When I turned 18, I went back to Ohio and married the man who took me to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. He was intensely abusive. Intensely abusive. He was sober at the time that he took me to my first meeting. I had no way of knowing how abusive this man really was. I found out a week before we got married. I was walking through the dining room and he tripped me, and I went flying through the air and I hit the corner of his pinball machine with my head. I had a dent in my skull. And when I came to from that, he told me I should be more careful. That was the kind of things that he did to me. I had three sons with him. It was just a really difficult marriage. And he relapsed shortly after we got together, got married, and came back out here to California. And I was grateful for that, because it was really difficult for me to hide my drinking when he was sober. And so I was really glad when he relapsed, because then I could drink too. I was not a good mother to my sons. I had three boys with him, and I was not a good mother. I was an alcoholic, a practicing alcoholic, and still very much a broken kid. I escaped from the marriage after 9 years of marriage, and I got with my current partner. Thank God she was codependent, because she's taken care of me ever since. When I left him, I was actually homeless for 7 months in Tucson, and then I made my way back to Fresno, and I was homeless for 9 months in Fresno. So there I was again. Like, my cycle just continued. Like, I lose everything, somebody gives it back to me. I lose it again, somebody gives it back to me. And the whole time, my alcoholism was in full force. I may not have drank every day. I may not have gotten any drunk drivings. I may not have gotten any drunk or disorderlies. But my alcoholism was in full force. In 2010, in January of 2010, my middle son, Corey, told me that he was addicted to heroin. Now, understand that I thought I was the perfect mom, you know, because I've been there. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I struggled with it myself. I claimed I'd been clean for like 20 years because I hadn't used a certain other chemical other than alcohol. And so I had it all worked out. Like, I told my kids, when you turn 18, if you have to have a vice, smoke weed. It's all good. Like, really, if you've got to have a vice, don't smoke cigarettes, because they'll grab you and they'll hold you forever. Anybody feel me on that? Don't drink alcohol, because you come from a whole family of alcoholics. Don't do meth, because meth will kill you and knock all of your teeth out. Just smoke weed. Everything will be okay if you just smoke weed. And I told him, to cinch the deal, I said, when you turn 18, I will smoke your first bowl with you. I will buy it for you, and I will smoke it with you, because that's the kind of mom I am. I just don't want you to use it before you're 18, because your brain is still developing. What I didn't know was that he started smoking weed when he was 14. He started taking opiates when he was 16, and he started shooting heroin when he was 18. And when he was 20 years old, he admitted that he was a heroin addict after we had discovered that he had stolen from us to the tune of about $12,000 to $14,000. We kept thinking our neighbors' drug addict kids and relatives were coming into our house and stealing from us. That's how denial works, folks. So we took him to rehab. And the rehab said I had to go to Al-Anon. Now, they really didn't understand who I was, because I grew up in Al-Anon. Actually, I grew up in Alateen. I like to say I grew up in Alatot, okay? Because I grew up in an alcoholic home, and part of my mother's public face was that she was secretary of an Al-Anon meeting. Like, we had it going on. They said, that's nice, now go to Al-Anon. So I did, and I got a sponsor in Al-Anon, and I started working the steps. Now, one thing I can tell you guys beyond a shadow of a doubt is that it is absolutely impossible to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and not change. I don't care if you're still drinking or not. Obviously, the goal is to stop drinking. Don't get me wrong. But I don't care if you're drinking or not. If you honestly and thoroughly work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you will change. And that's what happened to me. I started changing. And my son came home from rehab and he observed that I had started to change. And he said to me, one of the two things that he said to me that got me in these rooms, he said, "Mom, seems like you could have benefited from working the steps sooner." Out of the mouths of babes. So I fired that Al-Anon sponsor. Because we were done with the third step, and we were at the fourth step, and I wasn't doing that. And I got another Al-Anon sponsor, and I worked the first three steps with her, too. And then I fired her. Somewhere in there, I met my current sponsor. What had happened was I was at an Al-Anon meeting with a friend of mine, and in Fresno we've got my home group, Reality Group, has a sister group right across the grass that's Al-Anon. It's the Courage to Change group. And it was a Saturday night, and I was at the Al-Anon meeting, and my friend said, we were outside afterwards, and she said, "You want to meet my husband?" And I took three steps backwards and said, "Sure." And he looked at me, and he laughed, and he said, "I know that look. That look says I don't want to meet another fucking person." And he won my heart. He just totally won my heart, because he called me on my crap. Like, nobody called me on my crap. I am, okay, you probably think you can compete with me for this title, but I think I am the world's master manipulator. And I'm really good at convincing you that the crap that I'm spewing at you is real. And it's right. Like the way I convinced myself it was okay to tell my kids just to smoke weed. And he called me on it without ever saying a word to me, without me saying a word to him. He called me on it right then and there. I knew this dude was something different. And so I think it was about a month or two later, I asked him to go to coffee with me. And we went to coffee, and I said, "You know, I really feel like, you know, I don't need to go to meetings, but I really think I should be working the steps in AA too. I think I should be working the steps around my addiction." I was wasted at the time I had this conversation with him. And he said, "Well, you know, you're working the Al-Anon steps right now. So why don't we just wait until you're done with the Al-Anon steps? And then, yeah, that might be a good idea for you to work the AA steps." Okay. So I got worse. Because I had to prove to him that he was wrong and I was right and I should have been working the AA steps. Now, why it didn't occur to me that I didn't have to manipulate the situation, that all I really had to do was say, "I need help. My name is Dakota and I'm an alcoholic. Help me." I couldn't do that. My last drunk was not on alcohol. My last drunk was on Norco. I had a surgery and I got hooked on the Norco, which wasn't hard because I'm a good alcoholic. And it was a chemical that changed the way I felt. I had not done meth for 22 years, but the minute I got hooked on the Norco, I went right back to the meth. And I went right back to the booze. But my last drunk really was on Norco, and I hope that doesn't offend anybody, but it's my story. And Dr. Bob was also a drug addict. So, just saying. A week before I got sober, I asked Billy to be my sponsor. I had asked him to take me to a meeting. He took me to a meeting on the way home. I said, "Will you sponsor me?" And he let out this really long sigh. And he said, "Okay." And I said, "What was that?" And he said, "You're going to be high maintenance." I don't understand. He had no clue how spot on he was. But he agreed to sponsor me. 3 days later, I stopped doing meth, and I had a plan. I was going to taper off the Norco. Got it down. And so I went to my Al-Anon meeting that Tuesday night, and my first Al-Anon sponsor was there, and she was also an Alcoholics Anonymous. I forgot to mention that. That's important to my story, because she was also an Alcoholics Anonymous, and she kept taking me to AA meetings when I was working with her. And I thought, well, okay, I'm clean 22 years, but okay, I'll go to meetings with you. Like, she was carrying the message. She knew I needed it, and she was doing her part to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The other thing I forgot to mention is that about a month before I asked Billy to sponsor me, my son, the one who had that wisdom for me right after rehab, he had been in and out of recovery. he was struggling to stay sober. And one day I just like completely flipped out on him, and I was chasing him around the house trying to get him to fight with me, and he was refusing. He was amazing. He really was amazing. And he was just, I'm not going to fight with you. I'm not going to do it. Nope, not doing it. And I'm screaming at him and screaming at him. And finally, at some point, I realized I heard myself. I heard my mother coming out of my mouth. And it devastated me, and I broke down into sobs, and he sat next to me, and when I finally started to stop crying, he said, "Mom, you are in an untreated disease state." And that was it. That was it. He was so right. He was so right. So then I asked Billy to sponsor me, and then I went to Al-Anon on that Tuesday, and I invited my first Al-Anon sponsor to coffee, and I told her I relapsed, and she said, "Okay, what do you want to do?" I said, "I need help." "You're not mad at me?" She's like, we don't kick our people when we're down. And that was just amazing to me. The next night I went to a meeting at a member's house, and I told her she knew me and she knew my son, and I told her about my plan. Because I was still wasted. And I told her about my plans, that I was going to taper off of these Norcos, and then I was going to get sober, and I was going to work the steps, and everything was going to be wonderful. And she said, "Really? What would you tell Corey?" Ouch. I said, "I would tell Corey, just kick it. If you're serious about getting sober, just kick it." And she said, "Really?" And I haven't taken a mind-altering chemical since that day. The next day, July 21st, 2011, is my sobriety date. I got right into the steps with Billy. I didn't think that I'd done any writing around step one when I initially did it, until I had a newcomer call me one day and said, "Well, my sponsor wants me to write about step one, and I don't know what to write. What did you write?" And I said, "Well, I didn't really write anything about step one, because I already knew I was powerless." Because Billy's challenge with me was to figure out how to get me to internalize my powerlessness. Because I could rattle off the rhetoric any minute now, you know what I mean? I'm really good at that. And so the next time I met with Billy, I said, you know, I had a newcomer call me and ask me, you know, what did I write for step one? And I said, "You didn't really have me write anything for step one, did you?" And he said, "Open your book to chapter 3. So I did. And I found this. Right? I don't remember writing this. This is what he had me write for step one. Because, see, you guys read it at the beginning of the meeting. It says, "Heaven know we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some of the methods we have tried." This right here is my rewrite of that paragraph. My sponsor had me write that paragraph, drinking beer only, limiting, in my words, from my experience. I'm not going to share it with you because, frankly, it's none of your business, because I'm a real alcoholic and you get to trust me about that. But that's how I did step one, and I didn't even realize it. He was a sneaky one, that Billy. I'm not sure how he knew to get into me that way. And another thing he told me really early on is, "We're going to keep going. I don't care if you drink. I don't care if you use. I don't care what you do. We're going to keep going. We're going to keep working the steps. You are not getting out of step four by relapsing. So have at it." Step two, the book says, "Lack of power, that was our dilemma." I never thought so before. I thought I was so powerful. It was impossible for me to work an effective step one and not know that I was insane. So when I got to step two and it said, "Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity," I had no trouble understanding that I needed to be restored to sanity. The problem was, I had a relationship with a higher power since I was really little, but I felt abandoned by that higher power. I felt let down by that higher power. So I couldn't really think about surrendering to that higher power. So what I did was I surrendered to you. I surrendered to the 12 steps. I surrendered to the traditions and the concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what kept me sober for 2 years. Because I did not get on my knees and surrender to the God of my understanding until the eve of my second birthday, just a week and a half ago. Whatever works, people. And when I talk about God, you can be scared about that if you want. But what my steps say is, "God, as we understood him." And I don't care if it's a him or her. I don't care if it's an animal or a person. I don't care if it's a spirit. It doesn't matter what it is. If you pray to a fire-breathing dragon or the divine within or Jesus Christ crucified on a cross, it doesn't matter. What matters is that we need that spiritual power to help us do this thing. We have no mental defense against the first drink. I don't know about you, but I have no mental defense against that first drink. That help must come from the God of my understanding. And for a long time, you people were that, and I thank you for that. I went right into my fourth step. Less than 2 months sober, I went right into my fourth step, and at 47 days sober, I finished my fourth step. My son was at a conference, the International Conference of Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous, that weekend when I finished my fourth step. I had an appointment the following Sunday to start my fifth step with my sponsor. My son came home from that conference on Monday morning at 6 a.m. after spending the weekend with 4,000 young people in recovery. He came home at 6 a.m. Monday morning. He slept on and off that day because he was exhausted. It was Labor Day. He barbecued for us. The next morning, he left my house at 9:15 a.m., and he came home in an urn. Because we all have another run in us. This is what I know. We all have another run in us, but we don't necessarily have another recovery in us. My son came home from that conference, and he had to try it one more time. He had to see if maybe one more time he could just use heroin socially and make it back. And he did not make it back. Within 12 hours of the time that he left my house, he was dying of a heroin overdose. He was dying for hours. His official time of death is 3:02 a.m. on September 7, 2011. I was 49 days sober when my son died. And I'm still here. And I'm still here not because I'm amazing, but I'm here because this program works. And you know what I did 5 days after my son died? I did the first stage of my fifth step with my sponsor. I kept that appointment. I kept that appointment because now more than ever my life depended on doing this deal. Corey was an amazing boy. He really was. He was the most friendly, loving, caring, empathetic human being I've ever known in my entire life, and he was my rock. And if I stood here and told you that I wanted to be sober after he died, I'd be lying to you. And I don't feel the need to lie today. That is not in my repertoire anymore. Today, my honesty is all I got. And I gotta tell you, I did not want to be sober. I wanted to be dead. And I didn't drink. And I didn't pick up because I knew I would be dead if I did, because I was truly hopeless. I did not lose everything when I got sober. I've lost everything along the way, but I did not lose everything when I got sober. I still had a wife. I still had a house. I still had my children. I still had my car. But I hit my spiritual bottom at 49 days sober, and it took me until the eve of my second birthday to finally hit my knees and surrender to the will of my higher power. After I finished my last fifth step, I came home, and as the book says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn the page which contains the 12 steps. Immediately. It isn't like, oh, God, I just finished my fifth step. I got to rest for a couple months here. It says immediately upon returning home, we take this book down from the shelf, and we move right into 6 and 7. This is a life and death thing. It is so easy to get complacent in these rooms. But this is a life and death thing, and I'm pretty sure nobody knows that better than I do. There is no pain in the world like the pain of losing a child. And there isn't a minute that goes by that I don't wonder what I did and how I failed. I kept going. I kept going in my steps. I did my eighth step. I did my sixth step and my seventh step. I did my eighth step, and I'm still in the process of making my amends. But in the meantime, I'm continuing to take personal inventory. When I'm wrong, I promptly admit it. I'm working on that conscious contact with my higher power, but I'm real honest with you that I didn't get there. I didn't get there until I got there. It's two things I found out 2 weeks ago. I found out two things. One is watch what you pray for, and the other one is don't ask a question unless you're absolutely sure you want the answer to that question. And that's it. What happened was 2 weeks ago, I sat in my grief chaplain's office, and I cried because I couldn't surrender, and I wanted to surrender so bad. And I finally looked up and said, I look up because I don't know where the hell else to look. Please get me out of my way. And 2 days later, I asked a question that I did not want the answer to, and I didn't know it, and I got the answer to the question, and that answer to that question sent me into a crisis that finally landed me on my knees. I never had a pink cloud, folks. Even before my son died, I did not have a pink cloud. I was at a conference at 24 Days Sober called Serenity in the Sierras. Some of you might be familiar. I was at a campfire meeting at that conference, and I was miserable. I was miserable. And at the campfire meeting, I said, there ain't no fucking serenity in the Sierras for me. And I'm ended. I was unhappy. I got the newcomer big book that weekend. That was awesome. But I was miserable. And the speaker the next morning was at that campfire meeting, and I didn't know it. And the next morning when he started speaking, he said, the miracle's already happened. And how many times have we heard in this room, stick around until the miracle happens, right? We hear that all the time. I'm here to tell you guys the miracle's already happened. You're here. That's what he said to me that day. And I knew he was talking to me because I'm a good alcoholic. Also because I went up to him afterwards, and before I even got 10 feet away from him, he said the miracle's already happened. He said it again, and he said it just to me. And with tears in my eyes, I hugged him and I thanked him because I knew that he was right. And I had no idea what was coming 25 days later. I had no idea my son was going to die. But don't think for a minute that what that man said from that podium that day didn't help keep me alive. Because it did. The miracle has already happened, because the miracle is that we are here and we are sober. And I truly hope that each and every one of you treats your sobriety like the miracle that it is. Because you may have another run in you, but you are not guaranteed another recovery. And you can choose not to have another run on a daily basis. That's the gift of this book. That's the gift of this program. I struggled a lot when my son died for a long time. I'm coming up on the 2-year anniversary now. I struggled a lot with why did he die. And then I found the answer in the book. I found it here. In Into Action, it says the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. And then, in More About Alcoholism, it talks about our friend Jim. Some of you familiar with our friend Jim? Jim relapsed, right? The book says all went well for his time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. In Bill's story, the book says, faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic, for if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. That is my son's story. He loved Alcoholics Anonymous. You have no idea. When he was sober, he was in the high school telling his story, trying to prevent other kids from ending up where he ended up. He loved this program. He loved you people. He loved the steps, but he failed to enlarge and perfect his spiritual life. And that's my message today. That's part of my message. The other part of my message is this. You don't ever have to drink again. I don't care if you want to or not. You don't have to. You don't have to. And if that scares you, because that scares some people, oh my God, I never have to drink again? That's a long time. You're absolutely right. I don't know about the rest of you, but I've got 24 hours sober right now. I woke up this morning, and it didn't pick up. And that's all I had to do today. All I had to do today was not pick up today. And that's all you have to do today is not pick up today. One little day at a time. After my son died, my sponsor gave me a chip that said one picosecond at a time, because after my son died, it was one picosecond at a time for me. And if that's what you need, you do it one picosecond at a time, or 1 second, or 1 minute, or 1 hour, or 1 day. But you don't have to do more than that. You never have to drink again. You're home, and the miracle has already happened. Thank you for letting me share.